Well, welcome to our next episode of Tag Talks. I'm going to give you a little background here. So, I think every food safety professional has faced some kind of moment in their career. A test comes back positive, a pathogen's detected, and the system kicks into gear. Product gets pulled, resources get deployed, and decisions get made. And most of the time, that's typically the right call. But what happens when the system responds with equal urgency to a result that poses minimal actual risk to public health? What's the cost of that response, not just in dollars, but in things like wasted food, wasted energy, and resources diverted from threats that potentially matter more? And who gets to decide what's safe enough actually means? So these are some of the questions at the center of a new paper published in the Frontiers in Science this March, titled Balancing Food Safety and Sustainability, Trade-off Risk Assessments and Predictive Modeling. And that paper argues that food safety field needs to get more rigorous about weighing the unintended consequences of its own interventions and proposes new tools, including AI-assisted risk negotiation, to help us do that. My guest today is the paper's lead author, Dr. Martin Weidman. Martin's a professor of food science at Cornell University, where his research spans microbial food safety, risk assessment, genomics, and predictive modeling. His lab's work on Listeria monocytogenes and quantitative risk assessment has shaped how both regulators and industry think about pathogen control. He's one of the most cited researchers in the field, and he's not afraid to challenge conventional thinking about how we keep food safe. Martin, welcome.
Thanks, Ben, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have you here with us. So, I want to start, Martin, with kind of the premise that zero risk is unachievable, right? And I think, most people that work in the food safety space probably have that same viewpoint, that we can't drive risk 100% out of the system overall. But, and I think, your paper really leans into that. So when we think about food safety professionals, like, who's your target audience for this paper, and what's the specific intervention, that we're trying to make here?
Well, the target audience is broad. I mean, it starts, I think, on the top, regulators, right? It set excessively stringent criteria. Let's think about, Bacillus cereus, pathogen, but not very good at it. If you would set extremely stringent levels in all foods, you wouldn't have much food. It's even to a certain extent public health professionals, which might ask for recalls. We'll try to get recalls when the risk is very, very small and don't think about unintended consequences. But it's also, the people who do risk assessments. I think, when I sort of floated the idea of the paper, I often would get the answer, well, we're already considering the trade-offs. And I think that's true in many risk assessment, but it's an after the fact. It's the risk manager considers the trade-offs, and often it's in a non-quantitative way. And in a not as stringent a way as if we incorporate these trade-offs into the actual risk assessment. So it's a challenge for the risk assessors. Honestly, I think not so much for the food industry, because they already know that. They're already every day making decisions. One little thing went wrong, and they're like, yeah, this increases the risk of a pathogen contamination, which might increase the risk of foodborne illness. But it's such a small increase that it's, not, we're not going to recall, we're not going to not ship that product. I think that's the reality of everyone in the food industry. They make those decisions already every day. But even they could need help with more objective criteria, right? Let's, silly example, but your requirement is product is at 40 degrees at receiving, and it comes in at 40.5, right? You could just reject the load and not sell French fries or whatever it is for the next 2 days in your store. Well, that might be a good decision, but 40 to 45, probably not. But these are decisions everyone in the industry is still making every day. But I think better tools would be good for everyone.
Yeah, and I think obviously the industry's used a hazard-based approach for a long time. Going back to what the 1960s, that was when we first came up with HACCP for the space program, and it took a good 30-year period between the 60s and the 90s for it to get more widely used, especially within meat processing. And then obviously we've got FSMA and preventive controls, and there is kind of that spectrum approach to hazard analysis and, more risk-focused approach. Do you see, like, where do you see that balance getting off, specifically in terms of kind of the food industry application? I think the regulatory side sometimes, right, it becomes black and white, but do you see gaps, in how industry is thinking about that or using it in as a continuum of hazard to risk?
Yeah, I think there's improvements industry can do in using, when to use the different approaches. And I think, I think that a clear cut example there, a food sound, food test positive for, as a, let's define a ready to eat food test positive for salmonella, that's hazard based, not acceptable, not going to ship it. But then there's the much more nuanced, let's say I have a zone four positive for Listeria species. Am I going to throw all my resources at dealing with that? While at the same time, I've got 400 certificates of analysis, COAs sitting there that no one's looking at. I'm getting ingredients from, processors I haven't seen. The last GFSI audit was whatever a year ago, and I'm not even sure about the auditing body, how good they are. And I'm just accepting that and not spending time there. So that's where then it gets challenging, right? And this is what this paper aims at. You have to balance your time, and there's a risk without obvious hazard presence, right? Those COAs all tell me I don't have salmonella, I don't have listeria, but my own test results tell me I have listeria on a loading dock, So hazard, loading dock, no hazard apparently in these ingredients. However, when we look at risk, I think most people agree the risk is much higher in my ingredients than that Listeria species positive on a loading dock. And if we get those things wrong, we're not focusing on the real risks and therefore not making food as safe as we could with the resources we have. It doesn't even require more resources, it just requires better use of resources. And I think industry, I think, feels a little bit handcuffed. I'm not sure it's always. They, I think, often would know what they need to do, but they're like, well, the inspector is going to come walk in and they're not going to ask me about those COAs that all say negative for salmonella, but they are going to pounce on me for the Listeria species positive in my zone four sample. So it's that overall environment that needs to change.
Yeah, so what you would say is that the incentives in the system aren't set up correctly, potentially, in terms of sort of driving behavior. And obviously, you work with industry quite a bit, certainly as do we at TAG, but in, just sort of intuitively, what would you say is the percentage of companies that have that struggle? And I think some of it too comes from, to your point, we build these systems. We operate these systems, but they may not be always focused at the greatest risk, right? Because we've always done it this way, or people fall into just sort of the routine of coming to work and running their food safety programs.
I think every company runs it. The magnitude of it will differ. But I think if you get an honest conversation with someone in charge of food safety of any company, like, there are some true risks that we need to focus more on and be focusing on some things, or we're just not getting the same return on investment.
Yeah. And we'll talk about AI a little bit, further into our conversation. But, certainly I think there are a lot of companies out there right now trying to sort of sell the idea of agentic AI and how this could help you as a food, kind of manage your food safety programs. And just high level, kind of what do you think about that? And where is the technology right now relative to being able to sort of deliver on promise versus actual application?
I think we in the early stages. It's a really interesting situation. I do think there are sort of, I'm going to call it the naysayers, to say, oh, essentially like AI hallucinates all the time. We can't trust anything, which I think is not true. I think you can build some fairly reliable AI systems to help you with very specific questions. But I think we're back to the classic, hammer nail analogy, right? We got a hammer. AI is a tool, and we need to make sure we're solving the right problems with it. Let's not hammer or screw it to something let's hammer a nail. So you need to find the right questions. So example, I think, if you have a lot of COAs, you could scan those and have AI help you analyze them initially. Say, hey, take a look at these three. These just seem to be, there's something out of the ordinary here that someone needs to look at. Is it gonna, write you a perfectly fine environmental sampling plan with all the corrective action, all the root cause analysis? No, it's not at that stage. Does it help you overcome writer's block? So one of your food safety people doesn't sit there and staring at a blank screen for an hour trying to write an SOP? Yes. Should you trust the SOP it spits out? No. But now the person that has writer's block can really work. So I think there is an application where it can really improve what we're doing. And I sort of believe what I think everyone says, it will take away some of the repetitive or difficult tasks to allow us to spend more time on the stuff that matters. But it's not gonna completely, solve the issues. So that's where I stand.
Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, I agree with that assessment overall, though I always tell anybody that I work with, never trust, always verify, right? When it comes
I
to
couldn't
AI
agree
output.
more. Absolutely. Well, but it's the same. My sort of joke always is like, we used to have food safety plans written by a consultant that no one followed and no one knew where it was, and they were pretty bad. And now we have food safety plan written by AI that no one follows, that no one knows where they are, and they're pretty bad. And so I think the essential problem actually hasn't changed. How we get to the same bad spot has changed. It's now cheaper because I can use AI. And I think that's honestly a part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, there was an interesting, I'm going to go off my question list here a little bit, but there was an interesting paper published back in February from the Wharton School about cognitive offloading and just how people use large language models. And it showed that they designed the study essentially to randomly give right or wrong answers from an LLM. And 80% of the time, people still accepted the wrong answer because they viewed the system as credible. It was too much work. If you're familiar with Daniel Kahneman's work around kind of type one and type two thinking, they propose a new type, which is type three, and that's kind of cognitive offloading to these systems. Though I think what you're talking about is similar to, right, people are busy. They have a plan. They don't look at the plan because they're too busy to look at the plan, and they just become sort of trapped in their habits. So how much of this, that shows up in the paper that you just published is a human behavioral problem as much as it is anything else.
I think it's a human behavioral problem, right? And I think okay, you probably got caught this out, but I think you guys have benefited from cognitive offloading. That's what people do. They offload it to tag, they offload it to someone else. And I think it's not necessary. That I think it's just a reality. You've always had this, right?
Yeah, tension between time, resources, where the incentives in the system lie, So let me shift gears a little bit because I think, one of the interesting things that arguments that the paper makes is that, we're taking overly conservative food safety decisions, and that results in meaningful waste or potentially environmental harm. But when I read through the paper, and when we kind of compare that to things that might drive food waste, like cosmetic standards, quality standards, logistics, consumer behavior, do we really have a sense of the scale of the problem as it relates to food safety? And is there data on that? Or is that kind of more of an intuition from your standpoint?
I think you make a good point, Ben. I think the data, I mean, let's start with the data on food waste, right? I mean, there's some numbers everyone cites, and usually it's like 30%. And it's like, really? How, is it 30% or is it somewhere between 10 and 50? Who knows, right? I think going, and as we've gone through the same iteration in food safety, right? At some point, we had point estimates. We have 60 million cases of foodborne illness, but there was no uncertainty. There was no credible interval around it. Now we're a little bit better saying, yeah, it's 60 million. But the credible interval is pretty large. I think it is for food waste too. How much of that relates to overly stringent food safety metrics? Honestly, my intuition, it's not the majority of it, right? I think probably most of us can pretty much agree it's on, shelf life date labeling is a big one, and then food loss at the farm level, you You're going to sell 100 pounds of spinach, but you planned 120 because you never know what's going to happen, and you got to have supply, and your supply chain contributes to it, and some of these other things. So I think it's more, but I do think food safety and specific situation can make some very important contributions to food waste. Honestly, I think the bigger ones is really around food security, and then it's the trade-offs within food safety. But to me, I think different people have different takes, but we had two big infant formula issues, right? One in the US was, and I'm not talking about a CBOT one, I checked out Chronoback there a few years ago, and now the one in Europe is Cerealite, where massive amounts of infant formulas were pulled off the market. So now the average consumer is sitting there like, well, I still got to feed my babies. What am I going to feeding them? Right. And then I think, and we've seen this in the US, then the advertisements come about, oh, look at this baby fed raw goat milk and look how healthy it looks. And so there are the unintended consequences. We try to be overly conservative. We cannot take any risk with infant formula. Agreed. But we have not, I think, thought through the unintended consequences. What are the babies fed then? Are the risks higher versus, we're really reducing overall public health impact? So that's one of the big ones. And I think that was sort of embedded in the paper, but maybe it didn't get quite as much emphasis. And then there are, the secondary ones are that might be more complicated. We talked about within a facility. But then, food waste, I think, plays an important role in it. It's part of the bigger picture. So I think it's multiple stages where we just impact public health broadly with overly stringent food safety requirements.
The infant formula example is an interesting one because, right, you talk about kind of the unintended knock-on consequences of, right, people seeking other food sources or not having, access. Certainly we saw that with the Chronobacter issue here in the US and the need to, potentially import product into the US. But is that, if we kind of back up and look at root cause and sort of these issues around infant formula, is that a failure of hazard analysis or a failure of risk assessment or both?
Oh, I think it's in one case, you could argue it's a failure. If we talk about a cereulide issue, you could argue that. I think it's very easy for me and maybe you to sit and say, oh, yeah, I would have predicted that cereulide is an issue in some oil that I'm adding to it. And it all makes perfect sense. At the time being, I don't think I could have been there and would have predicted that. So I think you could say it is, but I think that's the easy way out. And I think I'm not saying there wasn't some level of recall necessary, but was the scope needed, right? And I think often that becomes the problem is if there's a certain scope of recall that will not have the unintended consequences. But then when we expand the scope, that some of these unintended consequences become an issue, that's when the problem really arises. And so I think there's a lot of things that hopefully we'll learn from that. But I think one of them is also how do we set the right scope of a recall and minimize those unintended consequences, right? Just like there's no zero risk, there's also not that about no unintended content, but minimize the impact of them.
Yeah. Well, that'll be interesting. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the AI risk model that you're proposing coming up. But, I think one area where we've got a tangible example of kind of that hazard versus risk tension is, in the way that the US treats El Mono versus like Europe and Canada treat it. And in just prepping for this conversation, I went and looked at the data a little bit. And, it does seem that the rates, the per population rate of LM in the US is a little bit lower than it is in the EU or Canada. Hospitalization rates in the US maybe a little bit higher, and so that again, it's multifactorial, right? It's access to healthcare systems, it's the surveillance systems that we have. But do you feel like there's an appreciable difference in kind of the trade-off between that, let's say, 100 CFU per gram limit in the EU versus the US? And how do, if we think about that in a risk assessment continuum, are we thinking about it the right way?
So I think there's many levels of data current. The first one, do I think the data support that Europe has a lower rate of listeria than the US? Absolutely not, right? I mean, is that can we do we have enough data and we account for all the issues you mentioned that there's any difference? No, I don't think so. So but I don't think that means because there's so many differences, I don't think that means, the so-called zero tolerance is always the appropriate approach, right? And I think there is, and I'm happy we talk about it because there's some of the nuances that you simply couldn't put in the paper. But if you look at, for example, this sort of zero tolerance in even in ready-to-eat products. So now if I'm a food company, I have the choice between, no, let's stop that. The important thing is I will have the same recall if FDA finds one listeria in 25 grams or 100,000 in 25 grams. Okay. Because the test is sensitive, it doesn't, there's not quantitative. But everyone, I think, will agree that a food with 100,000 CFU per gram is substantially higher public health risk than what one is one. Now, a company is going to try to implement things to reduce the risk of recalls and outbreaks. If they simply add growth inhibitors, they will reduce the risk of an outbreak, they will reduce public health impact. But they honestly almost there's almost going to be no reduction in a recall risk because the product still will test positive, most likely, right? Except for some boundary conditions where I have one listeria in 125 grams and it grows enough that now I have one at 25 grams. But that's negligible, and even others have shown that. But I can use other technologies and I can use the same amount of money and just say, let's just reduce Listeria. Let's go from 2% positive to 1%. I'm gonna use nisin. I'm gonna use some of those lethal these compounds that will kill Listeria. However, the survivors will regrow. So if I want to reduce recall risk, because that's what I'm gonna be regulated, I'm gonna be very tempted to use treatments that kill Listeria, even if it doesn't kill them all, and not worry about regrowth. While every risk assessment over and over shows you that if I can prevent growth, that's how I'm going to get the biggest impact. Right. So that's where it gets more nuances. What are people doing in industry in the real world? What are they investing in terms of technologies? Are these technologies really having the biggest public health impact? Because regulations treat 100,000 the same as they treat one, even though the public health risk is different. And I think those are some of the things I think there are approaches where we can address it. Sure. Maybe not in foods that support growth, but in foods that do not support growth, we can set limits that get at a high level of risk and then encourage people to prevent those high levels of risk by using the appropriate interventions, not the ones that just reduce the frequency of a hazard, but may not have that much impact on actual risk, on actual public health risk. So it's a complicated topic, right? It's not these one-on-one. We're always looking for the one. Why do we just change the US regulation to the European regulation? Yeah, that's not it. That's not the point. I think the point's much more nuanced.
So if I handed you the Listeria magic wand and you could write kind of the perfect way to regulate Listeria, regardless of US or EU or to you, what would that look like? I mean, if it's really kind of a risk-based approach.
So I think it's very, very, I think it's fairly easy for foods that don't support growth. And foods that don't support growth, I think it'd be a sampling plan where you're required to test five samples. And as long as you can have one positive that's less than 100 CFU per gram, you're okay. If you have two or more positives, regardless of level, it's not okay. If you have one of the five, at least one of the five, more than 100, it's not okay. So you have these sort of three, what is it? I forgot the name. It's like a
Three class
three
sampling
class.
plan.
Thank you. The three class sampling plans, I think, are really the ones that are probably the best get at risk because they address both frequency and level. So I'm a fan of the three class sampling plans. Now, if you go to foods that support growth, that's where it gets trickier, right? And I honestly think there, I don't have a magic wand to come up with anything better than what we have right now, which is, test 25 or test 125 grams, and it has to be negative. But I think in my mind, the focus would be much more on prevention and really, to me, addressing one of the shortfalls of FSMA, that we need to validate the Prerequisite programs if you're non-FSMA are the non-process preventive controls. I think FSMA magically, majorly failed us because it said, oh, we just need to verify those non-process preventive. We don't need to validate them. Which, if you take it at sort of face value, which what I do is like, all right, so we just need to monitor and make sure we consistently implement something that may or may not work because we never had to validate it actually works. And I think that's the real problem that needs to be fixed. And I think that's why we go back to the concept of opportunity cost. Let's move that money that we're spending on finished product testing and move it to validate some of these programs, you know, daily cleaning and sanitation, preventive maintenance, whatever they are to reduce risk.
Right. Yeah. Are you doing the right things well because you know they work, not just because you think they work? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure. Yeah. We've all seen that happen a little bit here
And that's the
and
problem
there.
with it too, right? It's like, I mean, some people are like money doesn't grow on trees. It's like there's, you know, if you spend money here on testing, at the end of the day, you're not spending it on something else. And the question I always ask myself is, could we spend that money we're spending here somewhere else more effectively reduce foodborne illness? And that
Yeah.
gets to me at the heart of some of these issues is that, and there are other people saying, well, these companies making them billions of bazillions of dollars, so they should just spend more. Well, it's not that simple either, and we can get into that or not, why it isn't. But I think if a company spends that much more, at some point they're like, well, I can make more money. The best people then will move it to another business where they can make more money. I mean, that's, and then we don't want that. We want the best people to work in the spend, be in the food industry, run food companies, and use their skills to make food as safe as we can, versus them going somewhere else and making more money somewhere else.
So it's a good pivot to the next question that I wanted to ask. And you know, let's say this paper ends up on, you know, the CFO's desk, you know, and he doesn't have a great, or he or she doesn't have a great understanding of kind of hazard assessment and risk assessment, things like that. Does a risk-based framework like you're describing here, kind of in its worst form, essentially provide cover for food companies to invest less in food safety while potentially saying it's better for sustainability? I mean, could somebody read this paper that way?
I think that's going to be the criticism, right? I mean, I think the honestly, probably the criticism of risk-based food safety always has been sort of subliminally is like, oh, this is just an excuse for industry to not spend as much money as they should on food safety, right? I mean, that's the bigger picture. And I think that's why, you know, there are different almost camps, and I think we got to move beyond it. But then it's got to be as low as, I think that's as low as reasonably achievable means. You know, as long as you have money in your pocket, I'm gonna grab the money and you should put it into food safety, right? And then there's the other side, yeah, saying, you know, that's an optimization problem and that's not the right approach. So I do think people will use that against the concept, saying we're just gonna be apologists for industry not spending as much money. I think, well, some CFOs use it for that. Maybe, but I think it's also right now food safety is seen as a cost center, right? And I think if we get become more rational about it, they may also it may actually bring more resources to food safety. Say, okay, people, we really need to assess these risks more rationally. And we while we at it, we need to look at all the enterprise risks and make sure food safety gets the appropriate amount of resources. And then it, you know, to a certain extent, it's back at public health system, right? And I think we have a good one in the US. If outbreaks and disease cases are detected and there are consequences because, you know, we still have Bill Marler, then the cost of not minimizing the risks as much as possible and as much as reasonable is too high. But I think it will lead to better allocation of resources to the right things, okay? Versus just the things that look good. And there'd be more requirement for stringency in those evaluations, right? Should you really spend, you know, I'm going back to, should, you know, should we really put our best person on that zone four Listeria positive, or should we put our smartest people on assuring our 400 ingredients that come God knows where? I think maybe the CFOs or someone will be saying we got to get more rational about those resource allocations.
Yeah. And that I think that was one of the questions I think on page 12 of your paper. So those that print it off and, follow at home in the PDF version.
Mean,
I
if
think
we're not using AI yet to just summarize it to one page.
I know I you'd be proud of me, Martin. I actually read it a couple times even. So, I think you call out here, you said building science-based systems will, however, require consensus on clear goals regarding foodborne illness risks, defined either using one, absolute targets, two, relative targets, and I'm paraphrasing here, or three, business risk-focused targets using financial or operational risk metrics. Is that kind of what you were talking about before? I guess I had a question in terms of what are those financial or operational risk metrics that you were thinking of?
Right, I think it's so. Give you one. I think one company might say, "Hey, there are outbreaks. It's well known. Let's say we work in a certain industry. There have been outbreaks before that. We want to make sure our risk of an outbreak is less than a 5% chance every 100 years." So, give me that. When you build a dam anywhere in the U.S., essentially, you need to make sure it's safe against, let's say, a 50-year flood or so. So you do some very clear estimates saying, this is the risk we're trying to manage. This is how bad it could get. And I think you can do that with methane, just like, hey, I want to be 99% sure that over 50 years we don't cause an outbreak. Does it mean we won't? No, because there's still a 1% chance, just like it could win in the lottery. But this is what we want. This is where we gotta be to be better than that. Or you could say, there's a healthy people 2030 is one of the things that mystifies me tremendously in the US because we actually have disease reduction targets, right? In 2020, we said we got to reduce salmonella cases by 25%. But there's not a single policy or anything that we designed to hit these 25%. We're not saying, you know what, we're going to set these limits, these performance standards for salmonella in poultry. Because within scientific evidence, it will get us to a 25% reduction. No one's using these established targets to actually drive action and drive policy. It seems like the action is just there to put some money on it, some percentage, some target on it, but no one's trying to take it serious. So that's the first one. I think let's take these targets, and if you're truly agreed on it, then use them. If you don't, then let's agree on a target. And then use it to drive policy. And then I think as an industry, once you have that, can say, okay, FDA or the US government wants a 25% reduction. We want to be industry leaders. Let's say we want to reduce 50% the risk of salmonella through our products. Very rational approach. And then you can decide how much better you want be than the average. Whether you want to reduce it 50 or 75, 98, 99. You go for it. So
Yeah,
that will be an example of how to do it.
and I think that kind of in my thinking comes back to right. Yeah, where are those risks and what are some of the more effective tools to address those? Where do you see, whole genome sequencing sort of sitting in that space, especially for microbial risk, for processors? Like, have we hit the point where that just needs to be part of their risk assessment toolkit in terms of sequencing positives they get in their environment? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think this, I mean, it's a very specific. I do think, if you're dealing with an environmental pathogen where that represents your major risk, I think using whole genome sequence or some subtyping method. I'm actually not necessarily always sold that you always need to use whole genome sequencing. I think the reality is it's not that easy, with some exception, but overall, it's not that easy to get access to where you get a result in 2 or 3 days. You can with some groups out there, but not that easy. While other methods might be faster, but to have some sort of subtyping to see whether you have a reoccurrence and have true persistence, because that's a much bigger risk than if you have, okay, I got Listeria A on my loading dock today, and 6 months later, before I had Listeria B. So it's sort of arbitrary incoming load that comes, loading dock's a loading dock that you expect there because that's where your raw materials come in. We're saying, okay, we had the same subtype there for 3 years and we have data supporting it. So that's a bigger risk. So I do think some sort of subtyping is valuable, and I think more and more companies are going to move towards it. Are we at a point where you can manage it without? Yes, I don't think it's one you have to, but you probably have to re react more stringently in some cases because you simply almost have to assume if it's the same spot, same time, that it's persistence. But if I have WGS, I can say it's probably not. It's like, lightning struck twice, and there's less I can do about that and should do about it. It's not the same level of risk for the consumer.
Yeah, and I think, again, to go back to kind of the concept of risk assessment, I know some of your other work, a lot of your other work has looked at Listeria and just, virulence factors, genes that, certain types of Listeria mono are much more likely to cause human infection than others. So is that type of sort of molecular work or subtyping useful, from a risk assessment standpoint in, for a food producer to think about?
You bring up a good question. I think the bigger picture question is, can we use whole genome sequence data to sort of, and maybe we call it risk assessment, maybe it's even more almost hazard characterization, right? To take what we think is a, what single given hazard, Salmonella or Listeria, say, well, within that group, they're really, some of them are less risky or less, some of them are higher risk, and we're going to treat them differently. To me, the big example really to me is Salmonella, where you have Salmonella Kentucky in poultry. It's the US is very frequent, but rarely causes human disease. If I want to vaccinate poultry and I just want to get Salmonella numbers down, I'm going to vaccinate against Kentucky because it's one of the most common subtypes. If I want to improve human health, I'm not going to vaccinate against Salmonella Kentucky. I'm gonna vaccinate against the two next ones, is probably Enteritidis and Typhimurium, but then I'm also gonna add Newport as number three versus doing Kentucky Typhimurium and Enteritidis because I want to hit the public health hazards, not just what's common. So I think that's an example where WGS, having the data from USDA, essentially I can benchmark what my different farms have. Are they high in Kentucky? And then do general practice, like what am I going to target as vaccination? Yes, you're right. Listeria monocytogenes, not all of them are equally high risk. Some of them have mutations that make them unlikely to cause human disease. I think it's a little bit harder to do risk prioritization there. I think some people might, that is, well, I got, two positives, I have two plants, I have a positive in a zone three, but I know one plant. It's a Listeria that we don't find an NCBI associated with human illness cases. We know it has a mutation that makes it less likely to cause disease. And in the other facility, same situation, we have a Listeria monocytogenes that has all the genes required to cause disease and similar organisms, not the same ones, not within like 7 or 10 SNPs, but within 30, 40 SNPs show up in the NCBI database. So clearly all evidence suggests this has the capability of causing human disease. I have my CapEx is five is a half a million. I'm not going to spend 250 in each. I'm going to spend 400,000 in one list in one Listeria and less in the other one. I'm going to send Ben. I'm going to tell, hey, David, send Ben to this facility. To the other one, he can send Martin. He might not be as good, and he's going to send him there. So you can, there's various levels of how you could do that. I think to prioritize it. And I think some people do use that information. I don't think it's just the genetic makeup, but also the comparison to databases, et cetera. I think that is powerful. Again, opportunity cost, put your money where your biggest risk is.
Right. Yeah. And all of that takes data, right? Like, I think that's the key is that in order to make that assessment, you have to have the data and be willing to put the resources towards characterizing those risks to some extent. Hazard is almost, I mean, I think that's part of what I'm taking away from your paper is sometimes the hazard assessment's too binary, right? But in order to make an effective risk assessment, just like you were talking about in terms of Salmonella policy in 2030, you have to have enough data to sort of say, here's a meaningful policy change, and here's why we would want to target, that particular exposure, to the human population. So just to, I know we're coming close on time here, but One of the things that I appreciated in the paper too is kind of an example that I think you talked about, and it was about waste, and single use servings coming out of COVID, right? Pretty early on, we understood that COVID probably wasn't transmitted through food, despite what the internet kept telling us. But people still had the perception of risk there, right? So how do and I think then what you propose towards the end of the paper is this idea of an AI-assisted risk negotiation tool where you've got stakeholder roundtables and AI-supported validation. A couple questions. One, that approach, certainly novel, it also sounds pretty resource intensive. So do we realistically have the capacity to do that? And then two, the general public, sometimes there is a disconnect, right, between true and perceived risk. And how do you navigate that in that kind of framework?
Yeah, so it's a tool that's not necessarily going to be able to be used everywhere, right? But I provide a little bit example of where this work started because it's an interesting one and it's relevant. So Bacillus thuringiensis, BT is essentially a natural pesticide, biopesticide. So you use it organic production in your mouth. The problem is there are a few instances where actually, if you didn't spend enough time between application and consumption of a food, foodborne illness case is pretty clearly linked to BTs or this Bacillus thuringiensis that was sprayed on product. And because it's similar to Bacillus cereus, which is a pathogen. Now, the risk negotiation is, should we spray BT on these products, therefore reduce pesticide exposure substantially, but have this extremely small risk of an extremely mild foodborne illness? And then on top of it, you add in certain regions in Italy, it's like you also have insect-borne viruses that if you apply BT, now you're also not going to have these viruses that can actually kill you much better at a much higher rate than Bacillus cereus. So you're accepting an extremely small foodborne illness risk with an extremely mild disease, but have other trade-offs, less pesticide exposure, less insect-borne diseases. What's that balance, How do you find that? And then big food companies are like, well, if you use too much BT in this area, we're just not going to buy from you anymore because we can buy our product from somewhere else. So it's that. And so to negotiate that trade-off with multiple stakeholders to find out what's the right middle ground was the sort of initial example of where we tried to use that and where it started from. So I think it shows that these are big. Yeah, big problems. So problems that are regionally that affect a large number of stakeholders, affect economic vitality of a certain region, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is where sort of the initial applications are. And the idea isn't to solve the problem, but taking this process of, negotiation and making it fast to say, okay, we put all of this into AI and AI says, most likely people can agree on those three things. Now let's sit down and say, are we okay with one of those three? What are the best compromises? You think you and I and many other people probably listen to this, and I get we've been in these endless, conversations. Do we do this or that? And one party wants this, the other one party wants. We just never get to an agreement. Where at the end, if we would have come to an agreement faster, everyone would have benefited, including, public health. So I think it's just getting to that faster because. And then the itty bitty, what I'm going to call the itty bitty risk negotiations, right? I mean, I have something happening in my facility. Get back. The product arrives at 41 degrees Fahrenheit and it's supposed to be 40. And one person's like, nah, we gotta throw it out. Rule says 40. And the restaurant says, well, but then we don't have French fries for the next 3 days. And then our customers are not gonna come. And it's this big wedding that we have. We can't do that. And it's like, how do you negotiate that? And by the time you negotiate it, it's too late, right? So can we speed up those processes? So I think. It's not one solution for everything, but I think it's a valuable tool for these high stakes negotiations to speed them up.
Yeah, and I think, right, in my thinking, some kind of framework like that would likely require some sort of regulatory involvement or oversight, right, for people to confidently use them. I think otherwise the risk is that, in a lot of systems, whoever essentially has, the most economic incentive or kind of benefit in that system might prevail. So it's an interesting concept. But I think the Italian example you give is a good one, kind of in looking at sort of broader public health risk at, mosquito-borne encephalitis versus kind of low risk foodborne illness. But yeah, do you have concern? I mean, again, just going back to the beginning of the conversation, obviously, generative AI is prone to errors. So how do you validate a system like that? Or is that yet to come? We're more in
Well, I
the
think
idea
it's
stage.
no, it's a good. So I think there are multiple ones, right? I think the first one is obviously, hallucinations. Honestly, that's one that's relatively fixable by not just using agentic AI that's trained on everything, but it's something called, retrieval augmented generation or RAG is what people start. But you give it the sources to use, and you can use the prompt engineering to not completely eliminate, but substantially reduce the risk of these hallucinations. And I think that will give us better answers there. Then, validation is important, but we know there was any risk with the risk assessments even without AI. I mean, you can validate parts of it, but can you truly validate that? Am I doing X, the risk goes down? Well, I can maybe after the fact, but with what I'm going to call real world examples, I mean, so many other things change at the same time. It's like, yeah, I think you brought up the example, Europe versus US, different policies. Can I validate that risk based at 100 CFU per gram is better? No. Does it mean there's no difference? It's not better? No, it's so many intricacy and complexity. So I think that sort of perfect validation is probably pretty elusive. Okay. But I do think what I worry about is AI almost more at this point, and it's probably going to change tomorrow, is bias, right? I think there's a huge, I would refer to as propagating bias in this, because, and I think that's one thing we do need to address in there, because it has so many dimensions of it that can become a problem in food safety, food security, food justice, whatever you want to call it. And I think the solutions to that are almost less clear than the ones to hallucinations, whatever, you have some technical solutions to it. But yeah, this field definitely is. I mean, I think I'm somewhere in the middle between, like, it's going to solve all our problem versus just creates problem. It's somewhere in the middle. It's another tool that we need to, use correctly and with caution, as you pointed out.
So if, the food safety field adopts kind of this trade-off framework, focus more on the risk assessment end of the spectrum, what would one concrete regulation or practice that what would change look like to you? What's one concrete example?
I think probably two of them, I mean, Salmonella, Kentucky, and poultry, or some of these not low likelihood of disease Salmonella, where, where we have a problem, we have not moved the needle, right? And we need to try something different. The second one then would probably be Listeria and foods that don't support growth. And then I think the third one would really to think about sort of the scope of recalls and the unintended consequences. We talk about infant formula. Another thing to talk about is produce, for example, right? I think there is, so how do we, there's so much, we find hazards everywhere. I was at a meeting where FDA unveiled their longitudinal study in Salinas, and they're like, oh my God, we found E. coli 157 in bobcats. I'm like, okay. Yeah, not an issue. Now everyone's going to worry about bobcats when they should be worrying about their wellheads, right? Which is because a bobcat goes into the produce field, like, nothing here for me to eat. I'm going to be back out of here. That's not where our risk lies. So that I think we're going to, and this has real implications, right? Because there was a large audience there. So I guarantee you, the people who know where the bigger risks are, now every time they want someone to invest $5,000 in fixing their wellheads, so it's going to be like, why are you talking to me? My neighbor has bobcats. I never had a bobcat. And then we're not moving the needle. So I think in produce in general, because the importance of this product for the health of the US population is so huge. We want people to eat more fresh produce. To constantly come up with some of these hazard identification and extremely low risks, and then maybe making it sound worse than it is, is not helping anyone. I think that's, and then you think about the massive consumption too, and massive production. Yeah, I think that's one thing. It's a little bit less clear of what I want to see, but I think some more truly, trade-off risk assessment and take into account the benefits of consumption to like extreme hazard avoidance. And where's that middle ground?
Yeah, kind of that balance of common sense, right? And trying to sort of look at regulation where it's maybe not as black and white sometimes is, yeah. And I think we've all seen applications of where that's, yeah, not been used maybe the way it should. Though I think that's a good place to wrap up. So the last question is, who in food safety or outside of it is doing work right now that you think deserves more attention? Who should we be paying attention to?
So I'm not gonna take the debate and name a name because it would be biased anyway because it's someone who, worked with me at some point or collaborated with. But I think in general is we need to start looking more outside our own, particularly when it comes to risk assessment. I think there's been and trade-off risk assessment and what's called multi-criteria decision analysis in fields outside food science. Take, finance, take whatever other field you want, enterprise risk management, et cetera. I think a lot of these problems, things that we try to address and solve have been addressed in other fields. And I think we can get there much faster if we look at some of those other fields. And as a group, and I brought up the example of the risk negotiation framework, it's called, it's was funded by some Swiss in Switzerland. It's called MICRIS. It's a group of researchers in Europe led by Sophia Joel at University in Munich. In terms of just how do we apply these concepts from finance to some of these problems that we described, where you have these One Health challenges. But I think overall, we gotta look outside our own field because some of these challenges have been solved. And even for industry, sometimes some of these challenges have been solved within your own company. You might be like, I don't know how we're gonna do this multi-criteria decision analysis, it just seems too hard. But then if you go to maybe your supply chain people or go to, financial risk assessment, like, yeah, here's what we do. We already got some of these standard tools, and we'd probably be interested in working with you on this. Look outside our own field, but take care because risk is ubiquitous, right? Everyone's challenge is finding the best ways to manage risks and not get sidetracked by some rabbit hole, but focus on the big issues. So that will be my final words there.
Very good. Well, Martin, thank you. I appreciate the conversation and the paper. It was good and thought-provoking.
Great, thanks. This was fun. Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Glenn.
Absolutely.